Hello and welcome to another episode of Rational Actors on Blogging Heads. I'm Kevin Glass, managing editor of Town Hall, and today I'm joined by...
I'm Patrick Brennan. I'm an associate editor at National Review.
Yeah, thanks for being with me, Patrick. We want to talk about a couple things today, but first, though most of the events have concluded, we wanted to talk about the Cliven Bundy case. Out in Nevada, where there was an armed standoff, basically, between Bundy and proponents and supporters on his side and the federal government, specifically the Bureau of Land Management. The dispute arose because Bundy's cattle had been grazing on some federal lands. And in 1993, if that's correct, the federal government decided that there was a species of turtle, the desert turtle, that needed protecting, and so grazing rights were regulated. And Bundy was supposed to be paying grazing fees. He has not been paying grazing fees, and for since 1998, when the first court ruled against him, he's basically been having his cattle graze on federal lands against the law, and the federal government finally... just recently started enforcing their rights to the land, rounding up his cattle and keeping them, and saying that, you know, you can't keep doing this. You're blatantly in violation of federal law, and so we're taking the cattle that you've had roam onto our lands. He said that he doesn't recognize the federal government's claim to that land as legitimate, so he and his supporters said, you know, we're not... Well, he said... I'm not paying the grazing fees. Give me back my cattle. I'll do with them what I want. So I wanted to kind of get your take on this because this hits on a lot of symbols and heuristics for conservatives, and that's kind of why it became this wildfire story in the conservative media.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that it took a little while for everyone to understand exactly what was going on, though. And so the facts that you've just laid out sort of were not clearly made, we're not, you know, sort of clearly displayed at first, and it wasn't until, I think, until Bundy did, he was on Glenn Beck's radio show or TV show or something, and he explained, and Beck said, you know, I just want to make it clear that what your claim here is that the federal government isn't allowed to control this land, and that because it's land in Nevada, it's automatically, you know, the only relevant authority is the county or your sheriff or the state of Nevada, even though the federal government holds a title to the land. And so his legal case is kind of ridiculous. There are certain odd strands of the conservative movement that do that, and it goes back a ways, who have this idea that actually give an incredible amount of power to county sheriffs, and so that sheriffs are almost sovereign in their own county, and that the federal government can't really have any sway over them. That's obviously an extremely uncommon view. That even for conservatives, and it's not one that most people in the West or conservatives in the West hold. And so what people look at, with, you know, if you talk to ranchers out West, which I have not personally, but a former associate editor of National Review, this guy Travis Cavola, is a public service commissioner in Montana now, and he's saying, you know, the meetings I've been to recently with ranchers, this comes up. They think this is just totally ridiculous. The guy's a freeloader, and it literally is the tragedy of the commons. So this is sort of like a classic economic issue. Like, you know, you have to, if you want to enjoy rights to an exhaustible resource, which admittedly desert grazing land is probably not rapidly exhaustible, and there's not much to exhaust, but nonetheless, you know, you can't have, you have to sort of pay in so that there aren't freeloaders. And so this guy's totally a freeloader. And I think it's somewhat unfortunate that conservatives embrace this as an issue, given how weak his case was. And it's become this sort of this idea, oh, you know, this is civil disobedience, and this is really about this larger federal overreach. And it's like, yeah, but civil disobedience is supposed to be you disobey a specifically unjust law. And the law here is not unjust, I don't think. I don't know if you differ.
Right. I don't think that the law is unjust, but I'm not a Western rancher, so I'm not really familiar with a lot of the issues around it. I think, so I saw somewhere that Bundy also claimed that he had familial rights to the land back in the 1880s before the federal government asserted their rights to the land. So that kind of complicates matters, but I'm not sure that that's all that credible either.
Right.
Kind of a tangential issue. But yeah, I think it's interesting, actually, that Glenn Beck himself said that he disagreed with Bundy's claims that he was making and disagreed with his supporters, and basically said that conservatives shouldn't be rallying around this guy.
So interestingly, I think that what is correct is I don't think this is a great example of federal overreach, because the federal government holds title to this land. And so, you know, even though he had sort of some sort of traditional freeholding rights from his family, I mean, you know, a title is a title. However, it has drawn attention to the fact that the federal government owns an obscene amount of land. And obviously, ideally, this would either be in private hands or it's held by states or counties. And the economic justification for that is, on principle makes sense. That there's no need for the federal government, and it's impractical for them to administer this land. And then also, there's a principle that when these states were admitted into the Union, that the idea was actually that the federal government took over the title from the land from places like Utah and Nevada. Montana's huge, Idaho, they own outrageous amounts of land that they would dispose of eventually, and they have not done that. The land is not ultra valuable, but there are ways to try to dispose of it. And that is something that it seems like the federal government should, you know, be pursuing.
Right. That's correct. And actually, that's been for conservatives who are kind of familiar with, states' issues further out west, that is a huge issue to them. It is the massive amounts of land that the federal government owns. And, the fact that, you know, even if we think that, there's not much to come of those lands, we do think, general conservative philosophy would say, you know, the federal government isn't the best holder of those lands, even if there's not a whole lot you could do with them. You know, we should decentralize it, give it to the states, give it to private developers, see if anything can come of that. And yes, the federal government does own, you look at some of the statistics, it is almost obscene about, like, square footage, well, acreage, I suppose, how much land the federal government owns out there. In Nevada, I think it's 80% of the land or something like that.
It's like 50% of California. It's incredible.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Jason Chaffetz is a congressman from Utah who actually, yes, he has a bill where, so just to give you a sense of the scale of what we're talking about, though, he has a bill that says that the federal government, basically ordering the BLM to dispose of 3 million acres that a 1997 GAO report found to be of private use and of no use to the federal government. So that GAO report recommended they be disposed of it. Nothing's ever been done about it because you have this sort of principal agent issue here where it's of little use to the BLM to sell off their land. It's not really going to produce a ton of revenue for the federal government. So no one really cares about this issue. And so the BLM just sort of holds, you know, just retains and there's an environmental, you know, sort of dominion issue. But if they disposed of those 3 million acres, that's just 0.5% of federal government's of the land that the federal government owns, and just 1% of BLM land. So this would be like a big deal, and it'd be a great step if they did it. But that's just 1%. So it's an issue that's not going away. But it would be interesting if this pushes, if we see a little action on it because of this.
It would be interesting to see if because this was something that did ring kind of the base bells for a lot of conservatives in the base, if that does translate to any activist movement or legislative movement, like you said. I would think that Chaffetz's bill would get more attention because of that, but I haven't at least really seen that momentum carry over into the national consciousness. I think something that I found interesting that this the kind of schism laid bare here was, I suppose, the show of force that the federal government had against Bundy and his supporters, and the power that I think kind of standoffs between the federal government and, legal outlaws or whatever you want to say, people who are blatantly defying the law and taking up arms against it. And it brought back, you know, memories of Waco and other kind of armed standoffs that we've seen in the past. And I'm not sure how kind of the median American reacts to that, you know, seeing armed standoffs between Western cowboys and the federal government over what seemed to be relatively minor bureaucratic land management issues, you know. But it does kind of, like I said, ring a lot of those bells for conservatives because it's, you know, it looks like federal government overreach. And this rancher who embodies a lot of the characteristics that conservatives kind of identify with, you know, Western entrepreneurial spirits, you know. So I'm not sure, and even though you see kind of, a lot of the elite conservatives like Glenn Beck, who you would think have those heuristics.
I'm not sure how he'd feel about being described as an elite conservative.
Let's say, I mean, movement conservative leader. I don't know what. But kind of, they're kind of split on the issue, even though you see this really grassroots support for it. And I don't know how much you've seen, but a lot of my website's readers and are along a lot of the kind of base, I don't know what you would want to call them, activist conservatives do see this as, you know, the time to take a stand against the federal government.
Yeah.
Even when it, to you and me and even Glenn Beck, it doesn't really seem like that kind of place to point out federal government overreach.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a slightly better example, presumably, of excessive, not excessive use of force, but excessive, you know, threat of excessive force, that they had the, you know, BLM snipers showing up and,
yeah,
I don't know, there probably were some, you know, some MRAPs or, you know, ex-Iraq Humvees showing up. I'm not exactly sure what the full array of weapons was, although, I mean, but it's reviewed in this case, I guess if there is, given that there were hundreds of people showing up armed, you know, for these sort of Oath Keeper, sheriff types. I mean, you know, you can sort of see how there was some need for this show of force, I suppose, but it does point to a real issue, which is the, you know, what I think is a real issue. I'm not so sure, but in it, there's a connection here between the sort of the right and the left about this concern about the overarming and the militarization of American police forces. And this came into distinct, relief just a year ago, basically today, when the Boston police and the state police and the FBI were trying to track down the Boston bombers. The images that came out of Boston, I'm from Boston, the images that came out of just like streets that, you know, in Cambridge, and there were MRAPs and, you know, and there were sniper teams strolling down the streets of Cambridge. It was bizarre. You know, and I guess that might be sort of another instance when it was like, we don't know how well armed these guys are. I mean, it did sort of make sense, and yet, but it was also a show of just how much hardware the law enforcement's acquired in the ocean. It's partly because we have all this leftover crap from Iraq that we would sort of have to cut it up and leave it there, or you give it to police departments in the U.S. But it does create this. It's a problem. And this guy, Radley Balco, who now works for the Washington Post, just wrote a book about it, about a warrior cop. And it creates a real problem. And actually, interestingly, police in the U.S. once upon a time were underarmed. And that changed in the 70s and 80s. They started just outfitting them with like more powerful sidearms, which, you know, probably that seems like it was sufficient for, you know, to do it. And now they're just shifting so far in the other direction. And it's the growth of this huge DHS bureaucracy. So that's something of real concern. You know, it's unclear exactly what effect that has in the way that law enforcement works, but it's certainly an odd sight. So.
Yeah, I mean, you ask someone what federal agency would you think you would stand a chance in a fight with, and the Bureau of Land Management might be pretty high on that list, but then it's quite clear that they have access to a lot of these resources. And Balco's book is excellent as well. I think When it comes to kind of those standoffs, I think that also fuels. I mean, I don't know if you've seen this. I've certainly seen this. These internet-based conspiracy theories about, you know, the IRS is buying all these armor-piercing bullets and, you know, new other. It happens in other ways. You know, federal government agency X is buying all these assault rifles. Things along those lines. And I think that this kind of feeds into that the BLM, which is not something that most people deal with on a day-to-day basis, is armed to the teeth. And that kind of plays into, again, one of these base conservative issues, which is fear of the federal government and that they have this overwhelming amount of power at their fingertips to enforce at any point. And when you see, at least when a conservative sees the federal government deploy all this force, and again, like you said, there were hundreds of armed supporters on Bundy's side, so the federal government's, well, BLM's response makes sense here. But when you see the federal government send out like snipers and heavily armed, what looks like enforcement agents, that kind of plays into the you know, we should be scared of the federal government aspect and the kind of more conspiracy minded aspect of kind of base conservatives.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think that there's, you know, there's always a limited degree to which that kind of suspicion is healthy. I mean, but sometimes they end up sort of missing, you know, for coming up with a more conspiratorial tone when there's sort of an equally valid objection to the way that government works and the way the federal government works. And so the ammo thing is actually a great example. My coworker Charlie Cook sort of looked into this at some point. And like, obviously, the idea that, so it sounds outrageous, you know, DHS is buying, you know, 7 million, putting out a tender for 7 million bullets or something. But the amount of bullets that Americans buy every year is such that the federal government's procurement can almost has no effect on the market whatsoever. So there's this idea, oh, they're buying up all the bullets as they're trying to raise ammunition prices and diminish the supply. That's obviously ridiculous. And the amount of bullets they're buying, and whether these departments are too large and have too many weapons and too many people who are armed, that may be a fair question. But the fact is that you just have to buy a lot of ammunition for training purposes. But one thing that Charlie found out, which is kind of amazing, is that they train. I don't know if it's DHS or which federal agency, but they were training with hollow point bullets, which are bullets that you use if you're going into a situation where you're trying to kill someone, use hollow points, but they cost like, I don't know, like five times as much as sort of ordinary cartridges. And so they're training with like bullets that are like $2 a round. And so, you know, this is sort of, that is the true evil of the federal bureaucracy for the most part, is is just buying unnecessarily expensive crap, you know, when they could just, you know, that sort of, it's about incompetency rather than malice, but.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You don't need hollow point bullets in a training exercise.
No, you don't.
I think troubles me about this is that and this kind of is a running theme for me, is conservatives at the activist level or the grassroots level keep picking the wrong battles to fight to illustrate their points, right? And I think that this is definitely typical of that. I mean, it's a guy who, and maybe, you know, a lot of this happened before everyone really knew what Bundy's story was. What it looked like, it might have looked to people, was just that this guy had his cows grazing on federal land. We don't know what the law is here, but the federal government decided to just take his cows, you know, and that might have rallied people to his side. But it became very clear very quickly that Bundy was in the wrong. He was just flagrantly flouting federal law and has been doing so for 15 to 20 years, depending on how thick you think his skull is. But it caught fire for a lot of conservative movement types. And it's not really a place where you want to say, you know, this is a huge, terrible, unjust example of federal overreach. Like you said, there are some legitimate issues here about land management in the West and how the federal government owns far too much of it. But this is not, you know, the grounds to make that stand on. And it's just for as a conservative who thinks that there are legitimate issues to be discussed here, it's frustrating to see people rallying around the wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's, I mean, but I suppose you do need, you know, you need an icon and you need stories. And so, you know, rarely do you get a story that's a perfect, you know, a perfect example of, you know, what's going wrong with the way the federal government deals with, you know, the Endangered Species Act or whatever. And so, like, this was pointing to, so the way that they deal with this, like, little thing, the desert tortoise, and say that they're huge swathes of the West that we can't, that people can't graze their cows because of one tortoise, or, and it, there's some kind of bird called a sage grouse that has led to huge parts of the West being unavailable for oil and gas exploration, let alone development. And that's under the Endangered Species Act. And so, the, you know, those are problems. And I think, but the question is really, is it, to me, is not so much like, you know, so we agreed that, you know, Bundy was in the wrong, but also that the way to respond to that is not by showing up armed and, you know, by saying that you're going to disobey the authority of the federal government and, you know, that you're, because you're a sheriff. It's just, you know, and I think that there was some wavering on this from some important conservative figures as to sort of whether, oh, well, like, you know, is this time for civil disobedience? And, you know, it just, I don't think we are in a situation where the federal government in even though there are these legitimate problems with the way that they're running land and the rapaciousness of the EPA and everything, you know, those don't call for, you know, we have courts that, you know, work pretty well, sort of. And it's not time for violent resistance, and even threats of violent resistance. And so that puts that is when, why bad things start happening, you know, and the federal government does, you know, mistakenly use force if we mistakenly think that it's time to threaten force as well. So, you know, obviously better if both sides would sort of stand down.
I mean, you can imagine a scenario where Bundy goes through the courts, you know, and again, I'm not familiar with the legal aspects of this, but let's say, you know, he ends up at the Supreme Court. What it looks like optically is, you know, old rancher wearing a cowboy hat who had his cows taken from him by the federal government over a tortoise. And that seems to be something that would be, at least optically, a lot more useful of a symbol,
right. Exactly.
Practically for the conservative movement, rather than showing up at his ranch with, you know, weapons to try and get it to, I don't know, photo opportunity because they didn't use force, but to try and get the cows back that way, you know?
Yeah. I mean, because it's not, you know, it's not clear that he would sort of triumph at the Supreme Court. And obviously it doesn't seem like, you know, the Endangered Species Act isn't unconstitutional or anything. So he wouldn't necessarily win. But what that would give you is that's, you know, we have Congress, conservatives control half of, you know, Congress. Maybe they'll control both halves in 7 months. And so, you know, if we think that the federal government is using the Endangered Species Act in the wrong way, then we should change the law. Yeah. And there's no reason to think that that's no longer possible. And so as long as that avenue, those avenues remain open, there's no justification for that kind of behavior.
Yeah. I think moving on to other avenues where conservatives maybe have kicked themselves in the pants, Obamacare. So I talked a couple months ago with Ben Domenech for Blogging Heads and kind of laid out my stance on it in January when it still wasn't going all that great. But I basically predicted, and a lot of other conservatives were on this train for a while, that Obamacare's not, it doesn't look like it's going to collapse under its own weight at this point. I guess, I don't know if you want to call it a hope, but the prediction of death spirals bringing down the exchanges and we'll have to tear the whole thing down and start over again isn't going to happen. Whatever you might want to say about, and this is kind of prompted by the latest enrollment numbers, whatever you want to say about them, it's clear that they got, you know, enough for the thing to be workable in the near term, right?
Issue I would take with that, I mean, I agree, and I think I didn't necessarily lay down a marker in that regard a while ago, but it was clear, even if they only got like 4 million enrollees, that the way that the law was set up, that there were going to be ways, first of all, that insurers were going to bet that this thing was sticking around politically, that was just there. If that's more likely than not, it's not impossible to get rid of it, but it's more likely than not that it will stay. And so that they were going to stay in it and that they'll absorb some losses. There are all these sort of cushions and the bailout, whether it's a bailout or not, you know. But the one thing I will say is that, I think it was sort of always going to survive in that way, but it is possible. And this will, I think it'll be interesting to see if there may be a few states, because each state is its own risk pool. And if a few states that have really messy exchanges that you're see, so we're not going to see like gigantic premium increases next year nationally, but it will be interesting if some focus becomes like a few places where the law is going really poorly. Mm-hmm. I don't know, that's one avenue of hope. I'm not sure I think that's even likely, but that does remain possible. Whereas obviously this whole national collapse is not going to happen. It never was.
Yeah. I haven't seen the state numbers, but I know Oregon was really in a bad way for a really long time, longer than the other states, at least when it came to getting their sign-up process working.
Yeah.
That would be interesting, but I think that if the Obama administration can say, you know, look, Oregon is kind of lagging here, but we'll get it fixed. Look at the rest of the nation. And again, because President Obama is in the White House, it's not going away, even if Republicans take control of the House, of the Senate. But it will be interesting to see, I guess, what kind of a status quo it settles into. And on conservatives kind of kicking themselves in the pants, they went pretty giddy over the struggles that Obamacare had in the beginning. And, you know, a lot of people did predict collapse, which was not, is probably not going to turn out. But I think that conservatives now have to retreat back to some of their original criticisms, which is that the insurance is going to kind of suck. The provider networks are going to be narrow. The premiums are going to be higher than President Obama said and the Congressional Budget Office and whoever else made predictions said they were going to be. But those are a lot more nuanced than the whole thing doesn't work and the whole thing's going to collapse.
Yeah.
So, and I think that progressives, and I've seen a lot of them, you look at places like Salon and the New Republic, very excited over conservatives having to retreat from this, the whole thing is going to explode position. And rightfully so, I think, because then it means you go back to these old arguments that we had, 4 years ago now, when the law passed. And these things take a lot more time to kind of pan out.
Yeah, for sure. So I think that probably one reason why people were excited to say, like, look, this thing's going to collapse under its own weight, you know, just by massively missing enrollment targets or whatever, then that wouldn't destroy it, but that would give Republicans some capital to be like, this needs some dramatic fixes. Part of the reason that conservatives were saying it is because it was like they really, it would be very, you know, it would be really nice if it had been true because it's an easier case to make. But, you know, you don't get many freebies in politics. And so, yeah, we had a fun couple months. Boy, you know, October and November were that was great. But but usually you don't win these battles so easily. And so what you go from is you go from like this, like, you know, having just an absolutely awful system. And there are awful federal programs that remain as well. So just because something looks awful and works terribly doesn't mean that it's easy to get rid of either. But, you know, so you move then, right, like you said, to a more nuanced case. And so it has to be, okay, was the benefits that we've gotten worth the cost? So what we're spending, is it reducing the uninsured as much as predicted, as much as we want? And I think that that will, you know, we'll have to see. It's really hard to tell. And it's unclear if we'll ever know very well, honestly. So there will, these debates will probably go on like forever, but there are preliminary indications that it hasn't, that the exchanges plus Medicaid haven't covered a lot of new people, that the up to 26 thing haven't gained insurance for a lot of people. Yeah. And so when you look at the sheer size of the law, that may turn out to be, you know, but again, that's a case of trade-offs. You have to say, like, you know, that it's not doing X and Y things as well as it at the cost that we wanted it to do, which is not an obvious case. A lot of liberals obviously just sort of don't care. They tend not to think too much about the cost of legislation, and a lot of Americans just wouldn't pay attention to it. And then what you also get into is, you know, just saying like, oh, there are all these hidden costs and counterfactuals. So it's like, oh, well, you know, premiums are not going to keep shooting up. necessarily. I mean, they will keep going up, and so that's going to provoke. But, you know, you can say, look, premiums would be much lower had we never passed this, and then if we pass a free market healthcare reform, that there are ways to make that work. But then that's right. It's a harder case to make, and
I think that the right generally looks at, like you said, programs that are run by the federal government and are terrible programs and sees how undoable they are. And that's why it was kind of a throw the kitchen sink at Obamacare before it really kicks in, because once it kicks in, it will be so much harder to change anything. And like you said, it gets into kind of the here's how Obamacare was sold and here's what's happening, rather than Obamacare just doesn't work at all, you know?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, you said Obamacare was going to cover 30 million previously uninsured. It only covered 15. So let's get rid of it. That doesn't ring as true. Or, you know, you said Obamacare was going to, this one will probably be more accurate, but lower premiums by $2,500 a family.
Yeah, that one will stand up, but yeah.
Well, and even that case is nuanced on the part of the proponents, though, because it's like Obamacare will lower premiums by $2,500 over the projected cost increases that are going to happen already. Mm-hmm. So, like, that gets, like, the case, the nuanced case is kind of, I don't think that's going to be a huge motivating issue for the American politic in the future. And that's why conservatives were going so hard at it before now.
Yeah, I totally agree. I will say, I think that there are two things that require that they're a little bit into the weeds and there's a little bit nuanced, but they are big issues that will remain, I think, a black mark against Obamacare. And I think what can be used to push for free market reforms. How sweeping those will be, I'm not sure, but let's just say. So one is we're starting to see healthcare costs heat up again. And so that the growth of healthcare costs is probably not going to be the disaster for the federal budget that we thought it was going to be, because I think that there are arguments that sort of we've moved to sort of a secular drop in healthcare inflation. However, healthcare costs are still rising significantly or will go back to rising noticeably faster than inflation. And that is a huge problem for the national fisc. So that's not going to go away. And so that will certainly always be a reason why Paul Ryan's Medicare plan is just going to make sense. And that it will still hold the attention of sort of centrist, moderate, you know, sort of some moderate Democrats, but certainly sort of elite centrists who think that that's something that needs to be done. And you know, it doesn't seem like Obamacare is going to fix that. There's still some hope that from the left that it will, but it doesn't seem like it's going to fundamentally reverse that. And I think that liberals know that because it requires structural changes. And then, second related is the continuing growth of premiums. And so people are going to, health insurance will remain ridiculously expensive in the United States. And now they're going to have people have subsidies to help, make it more affordable, but that will continue to be a problem that so I think, you know, given that we don't really think, there are some liberals who think that Obamacare will help fix both those things, but I think the consensus is that it may help at the margins, but it's not going to fix either of those issues, and those will remain, you know, I hope sort of central issues that can be used for conservatives at some point to say, look, it's time to give our ideas a try.
I think the Ryan Medicare plan is a good point, because that kind of exists outside of the Obamacare debate in general. It's just kind of a Medicare reform plan. And I think that, so here's a question that I have. I don't, maybe you know the answer to this. Part of the health cost slowdown was a fairly large slowdown in Medicare costs. Well, at least how it affected the federal budget. And part of how Obamacare pays for itself, at least, or is supposed to pay for itself, is they have the Independent Payment Advisory Board to make recommendations about cost control measures in Medicare. But the health cost slowdown means that that IPAB doesn't have any work to do, basically, for the first 10 years of Obamacare to, quote-unquote, pay for it. And we've also seen people still claiming kind of deficit reduction from Obamacare. Mm-hmm. But if, and I don't know how exactly this is scored in the budget, but if this means that basically we would, if Obamacare never happened, we would have all of the savings, all of the deficit reduction from Obamacare's recommendations for Medicare, but none of the, you know, coverage expansion costs. Yeah. So I guess my question to you is, do you know if that, I mean, does that really score according to the CBO as deficit reducing?
Yeah.
I mean, if IPAB is scheduled to cut to constrain Medicare costs by $700 billion and just kind of isolated Medicare costs slowed themselves by $700 billion,
yeah.
Does that count as deficit reduction for Obamacare's score?
That's a good question. Yeah, I mean, it did when they scored, you know, when the CBO initially scored the legislation, right? Because in 2010, yeah. they said, look, here's projected Medicare increases, and now, you know, IPAB is going to haul those down. So, yeah, I mean, that's interesting. That may be a sort of a good CBO report someday, is that, you know, that restraint in or, you know, that this slower cost curve in Medicare, you know, can't be attributed to the ACA. What, of course, I'll have to say is that, well, we don't really know what it can be attributed to.
Right.
And I think that's hard to say. And you can always attribute it to other things in the Affordable Care Act. And
yeah,
in isolated, in certain instances, I'm sure there's a very reasonable case for that. But yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point that Obamacare sort of would not actually, should not be counted, should not be viewed as deficit neutral. If in fact the savings would have, you know, if in fact we would have seen $500 billion in Medicare savings otherwise, because right. we hadn't spent all the money on it. Yeah, no, I think it's a great point.
I think there was the Kaiser report that estimated that, I guess, 30% of the cost slowdown might have been due to effects of the ACA. Mm-hmm. But that still means that, you know, 70% of it isn't. So if you take $700 billion times 30%, and that's the true Medicare savings from ACA. I don't think that would be acceptable.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, but because there are parts of the ACA, but it's marginal because it's moving. It's on, you know, people are on the exchanges, but you know, the way that in order to keep premiums from, you know, growing even more than they did, which was of course a huge amount, but in order to prevent even more rate shock, you know, places have adopted narrow networks, and I think that's another place where Republicans may have sort of shot themselves in the foot, is that narrow networks are actually not a very bad idea for cost control. It's not something people like, but you know, if you fix Obamacare the way we'd like, people will be able to purchase. You know, we'll be able to more easily afford a broad network, or you know, sort of a broad network PPO plan. But it, you know, that's actually not sort of ideal. What we'd want is to offer them options, and if people can see. So Kaiser actually did a poll on this where they said, like, well, you know, would you prefer to pay more, significantly more, to get a broader network? Most people said no. So people should have the options, but it's actually not a bad way to slow costs. But it also led to higher deductibles. And there are ways that Obamacare, just because it's raising costs in the employer market, plus eventually the Cadillac tax, is pushing up deductibles there. And so, yeah. But the thing is, sort of, those are all things that, like, we would have liked to do our own way.
Yeah.
Right. So rather than putting in the Cadillac tax, actually sort of changing, you know, there are various ways to do it, but changing the way that the tax treatment works of employer provided coverage. And so, but so those things, yeah, I mean, I get, you know, you can sort of chalk them up to the ACA, but ultimately they aren't so bad.
Yeah. There's a weird line of political attacks, both from the left to the right and from the right to the left, over things that are kind of broadly agreed upon. Like you said, narrow networks definitely help constrain costs. And the more nuanced view is that, you know, narrow networks might be a good thing, but Obama said you could keep your doctor. And so while, you know, most Republican reform plans would not let you keep your doctor, we never promised that in the first place. Obama was the one who made that promise.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I think that a lot of people see that as, well, Republicans would promise us that we could keep our doctors under any Republican plan, which is not true. And unfortunately, that will be kind of a feature. I think that will be a feature of healthcare debates going forward, is whenever anyone proposes a sweeping reform plan, the will you be able to keep your doctor question, because Republicans made it so central over the last year or so, is going to be important in the future.
Yeah.
And for the most part, that's a bad thing. And health experts on both the right and the left don't particularly value keeping your doctor when it comes to reform plans.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, it's that there's even more of it's even more of a prominent issue with deductibles. And there was this kind of, like, I don't think I ever wrote anything, but there was this sort of odd, like, liberal line where it was like, look, Obamacare is producing high deductibles. Why don't conservatives like it? And it's like, yeah, we don't mind that. But the reason that they're having high deductibles is because it's the only way to hold down premiums. And so, you know, previously people would be able to choose a premium with high deductible and lots of cost sharing and low premiums and you know, or high premiums and a low deductible, and now they get stuck with a high deductible and high premiums.
Exactly.
So it was like fairly obvious what the problem was there, is that the costs, part of the costs of Obamacare were being reflected in deductibles, which we think was a good thing. But we were just saying, look at all the costs of community rating and age rating and every, you know, limited age rating.
Yeah.
That they were getting put into cost sharing.
Yeah. And I mean, the Cadillac tax is another, is that when McCain had his fairly good health reform plan in the 2008 presidential election, he was attacked for taxing your health benefits. Whereas a lot of that, we've seen a lot of that, and we will continue to see a lot of that when it comes to kind of people want to equalize tax treatment of health plans, whether you're employed or unemployed, right?
Yeah.
And that's a major feature of a lot of reform plans, both right and left. But the desire to have an attack line seems to overwhelm the desire to have good policy here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one sort of note of optimism, it's an odd one, but is that Obamacare has so distorted our system and pushed up premiums so much that in order to say, okay, look, we're going to start taxing your health benefits. That's not exactly how we'll put it, but, you know, we're going to equalize treatment and, you know, remove the penalty for buying insurance on your own. And that, of course, the attack from Democrats will be, look, you're taxing health benefits. But what we'll be able to say is, like, look, here are going to be the real benefits. Like, you're going to have way more options than you had. You're going to have more portability. And so there will be, because it's the exchanges and everything are now so overregulated, that there will be there will be real benefits. And, like, if we believe what we're saying on healthcare, you know, there we can say, like, this is what you're going to get in return. And so we'll be able to promise real benefits. And so hopefully that will be able to outweigh that's a tough attack. It's, you know, nothing, it's not going to be easy.
Right. I think translating good health policy into salient political speech is very difficult, especially for our current politicians.
Yeah.
I think that's about all the time we have for today. So thanks, Patrick, for joining me. And I will see everyone else next time on another episode of Rational Actors.
Thanks so much for having me, Kevin.